Basically, given that we're limited time, I'll do kind of bits of a longer paper, basically all the negative bits and not the positive bits, but you can ask me about the positive bits in the Q&A. Begin with the following observation. It seems that our evaluative and normative concepts and judgments play some kind of practical role for us. For example, very generically speaking, you might say that help us rank states of affairs, items of some other sorts, but also in some way guide us towards the higher ranked items as opposed to the lower ranked items. Then there's lots of variation about how exactly this should be cast out. For example, some people might think that concepts or judgments get to count as evaluative or normative only insofar as they play some such practical role. Not be so plausible for certain types of evaluative normative judgments, such as judgments about goodness of a kind or so-called thick evaluative concepts. But you might think that the following kind of thing would be broadly agreed, that at least kind of thin evaluative and normative concepts, those that are expressed at least in certain uses of terms like right, ought, and good, in some way play a practical role, at least for rational agents who have a normal conceptual understanding. My question today, how is that kind of practical role of at least thin, evaluative, and normative terms or concepts and judgments reflected in language? So quite often meta-ethics people don't bother too much distinguishing between discussion at the level of mental representations, concepts, things of that sort, and then linguistic representations on the other hand. But it seems fair to say that often there's kind of implicit assumption that thin evaluative terms, I'm taking good, right, and ought as the examples here, play a certain kind of practical role or associated with a certain kind of practical role somehow as a matter of meaning. So what I want to do today is to try to articulate that kind of idea, which is rarely done. It seems to be kind of implicit in lots of meta-ethical discussions of evaluative concepts of language, and then tell you why we shouldn't think that thin evaluative language plays a practical role somehow as a matter of meaning. In a longer paper, I sketch an alternative pragmatic explanation of practical role, but I won't have time for that today. It might be helpful to kind of begin with just like a thumbnail summary of the kind of argument I'll be giving, so that's on the handout. So the project is hermeneutic. It's supposed to be about how our evaluative language works, in fact, or actually, not how it should work. And the basic argument is going to take the following kind of form. So whatever else analysis is, it involves conventional regularities and meaning. So when we build some feature into our semantic theory of some expression, we should expect that feature to show up in all normal contexts where the expression is used literally. But, as I'll argue, terms like ought can be used even in kind of normative contexts, even setting aside epistemic uses of ought aside, to assert thin evaluative claims which don't play the kind of practical role that seems to be, that ought very often seems to be associated with. So then we have a choice. Either we should really try to offer a plausible explanation of why these practical features don't show up in these cases, despite the role that they are assigned in our semantic theory, or else we should not build them into our semantic theory of the expression or expressions in question. And then I'll argue plausible explanations of why these features don't show up, which would vindicate some kind of semantic view of how thinking about it terms are associated with the practical role, don't look to be very forthcoming. So I'll conclude we will have at least strong reasons to doubt that the semantic account is correct. Okay, so unfortunately, this is one of those cases where I'm kind of trying to lift all the Lincoln's assumption and subject it to scrutiny. So that means I'll need to do first some legwork on behalf of my opponents. By way of saying more about what sort of thing the practical role in the evaluative concept might be, and then how it might be thought to be involved in the meanings of evaluative terms. So, just a bit of kind of stage setting, I'm perfectly happy to be quite liberal about concepts. So I have no problem saying that people can have, and many of us actually do have, evaluative concepts that are somehow constitutively tied to some kind of practical role. So my focus is very firmly on how this might be reflected in language. What that means is that, so obviously lots of people might not be interested in evaluative normative language in its own right, but even if you kind of, if you're more interested in just how things go at the level of concepts and judgments, it might be too rash to conclude that looking at language is just kind of like a esoteric interest. So for example, if it turned out that evaluative language is not semantically tied to a certain kind of practical role, then that would mean that our evaluative normative discourse could be in perfectly good working order, even if many participants in that discourse did not have concepts, evaluative concepts that are somehow consistently tied with a practical role. So that would say something about what kinds of presuppositions are indispensable for our evaluative normative discourse. Then various meta-ethical views, here's another example, various meta-ethical views, at least fairly centrally, involve also claims about evaluative language. So expressivist views of judgments, the expressivist bit is the idea that a certain kind of non-cognitive states are, the primary function of evaluative language is to express certain kinds of non-cognitive states. So it seems like if what I plan to argue today is on the right track, that's going to pose some kind of complications or difficulties for expressivists. Same for inferential or conceptual role theorists, insofar as they want to also account for evaluative and normative language in terms of the inferential or conceptual role of practical of evaluative and normative terms, and if that role is some kind of practical role. So those are a couple of kind of broader potential ramifications of what I'll try to say in the next half hour. If I have time at the end when I wrap up, I'll mention a couple more. Okay, so now, legwork on behalf of my opponents. What sort of thing might the practical role of an evaluative concept be, and how might it ought to be involved in the meanings of evaluative terms at the level of language? So first of all, it looks like we do seem to have some kind of intuitive grasp on the notion of practical role. So for example, we recognize that, for example, big evaluative terms like kind or selfish seem to play a different kind of practical role from thin evaluative terms or concepts like many of those that could be expressed by using terms like right or and good. We might think that aesthetic judgments play a different kind of practical role to moral judgments, and so on and so forth. But if you can compare the practical roles of different evaluative concepts, it seems like we must have some kind of, however previous or tacit, some kind of grasp of the notion of practical role. Now, if you look at how people discuss these kinds of things, it seems like you can understand the practical role of thinking about the concepts broadly in two kinds of ways. One might be in terms of like causal dispositions. So, for example, if you sincerely apply certain kinds of ought concepts to some action, that means that you incorporate in your planning, or that you end up in being certain kind of motivational state. So that might be one way to go. For purposes to fix ideas, however, today I'll understand practical role instead in terms of practical commitments. So the idea is that judging, for example, that you ought to buy in some circumstances C, the practical role of auth concept there would be that making that kind of judgment commits you to thinking or feeling or acting in certain ways with respect to buying. So for example, forming an intention to buy if those circumstances arise, or disapproving those who don't buy in those circumstances, or something of that sort. Either sort of conceptual role can be will be more or less rich depending on what kinds of meta-ethical isms you accept regarding it, whether you are some kind of motivational internalist in the case of causal disposition, conception of practical role, etc., etc. I'll leave that as a downstream question. Okay, so I'm very happy to say that we can have, and many of us probably have, thinking about the concepts that play some such practical role, maybe even somehow as a kind of matter of the constitutive of that concept. But again, the question is, how is that reflected in language? Well, if thinking about the concepts do play some such practical role, it seems reasonable to expect, you might think, that the terms that can be used to express those concepts at least would tend to play such roles. But saying that thinking about the terms play a practical role is one thing. Saying that they do somehow as a matter of meaning is another. Okay, how might that kind of view go? Well, with some gross simplification, We can kind of divide our overall theory of linguistic communication in broadly kind of three kinds of parts. One would be kind of matter of first order semantics. So this is where you have things like group relational semantics, an account of that tells us, in the case of truth conditional first order semantics, what the truth conditions of certain kinds of sentences are. Then there may be other that will tell us how we get truth conditions for sentences from the truth from semantic values of consistent expressions and how they compose. So it could be compositional semantics. Compositional semantics would be part of first order semantics. And then there may be various non-compositional parts of first order semantics. Then we can think that there's something called metasemantics, which I'm here understanding as a kind of, in virtue of what do various expressions and the complex expressions they compose have the semantic values that they are assigned in our compositional semantics. What explains why those expressions have the semantic values they do? And then, third part, we can think that there's something pragmatics, which is about somehow about how, what kinds of other things we can convey using language given what we know about what they mean from semantics. And of course, that's oversimplification because there's all kinds of controversy about how exactly should be distinguished, etc., etc. But for my purposes here, I just need to kind of have a kind of very simple distinction. I think it's good enough for my purposes, but you'll tell me if you disagree. Okay, so now. It doesn't seem to me very plausible that if thinking about the terms like ought, play, certain kind of practical role, that practical role is part of the truth conditions of ought statements. For example, it doesn't seem that, you know, part of what I make a claim about when I say that I ought to help the poor is that it seems to be part of the truth conditions that I am somehow committed in certain practical sorts of ways towards that kind of action. So it seems to me that a more plausible way, one more plausible alternative, is to go metasemantic. So what you have in the handout is first a statement of what a metasemantic view of the practical, how practical roles of being relative terms are associated with those terms might look. So here's kind of something that's first pass. So an atomic sentence S, partly composed by a thing evaluative term, so like S ought to twice, a sentence of that form, for example, has the semantic value it does, whatever it is in our first order of semantics, at least partly in virtue of the fact that an assertion of that sentence affirms commitments whose satisfaction would require the speaker to think, feel, or act in certain ways. So, for example, on this view, the semantic value of good, when it expresses a thing about the concept, can only be something such as an assertion of a sentence of form X is good, commits the speaker to some such responses as approving or commending or promoting or something like that, X. Now, shortly we'll get to all kinds of caveats, that's really just the first part. You might think that that's a kind of tempting view, given that terms like good and ought are semantically underdetermined. We don't get any determinate claims about what a sentence like X is good says unless context fills things in various ways. So you might think that if thinking about the terms are semantically undetermined in a kind of way, so that no particular standard or no particular descriptive information is semantically encoded, well, what might be better to anchor meaningful connections between very different applications of those terms by different speakers than something like a shared practical role? So there might be one very quick way to motivate this metasemantic view. Most of my discussion today will focus on that metasemantic view, but just to give you a flavor of what another option might be like, so now we're on page 2 of the handout, would be that practical role would be some non-compositional feature of first-order semantics. So that's something that goes into compositionally formed truth conditions of invalid sentences, but something else. For example, an assertability condition. So here's again, just to give you a flavor, it's a first pass on an assertability condition, incorporating the practical role of the invalid term. So this might go something like follows. An atomic sentence S, partly composed by a thing invalid term, is assertable only if the speaker endorses commitments whose satisfaction would require her to think, feel, or act in certain ways. So the idea would be, you sincerely assert the sentence of the form X is good, only if you endorse a commitment to responses like approving or commending X. Okay. what I'm going to do now is to give a couple of initial reasons to pause before kind of going into endorsing either of these sorts of views. And then I'm going to give hopefully more careful and detailed argument that also takes care of various kinds of complications and caveats. That's going to be mainly against the meta-semantic view, but I'll briefly try to flag also how the discussion might run into kind of reasons to doubt the assertability conditioned view as well. Okay, so that's where we're going. Alright, so here's kind of first initial reason to at least pause before going into any kind of semantic account of the relation between thinking about the terms and the kind of practical role that that they are often associated with. So everyone will need an account of what makes particular uses of words to value. It's well known that even words that we might typically classify as non-evaluative can be used evaluatively to communicate evaluations in a suitable sort of context. We can also observe that certain kinds of terms that many people would classify as evaluative, racial slurs, aesthetic terms, thick, ethical terms, can be used in ways that play some kind of practical role, but it's just controversial for each of those categories whether there's a semantic tie even to evaluation, for example, positive evaluation when we call something kind, let alone whether there's any kind of semantic tie to a practical role that such a term might play for a speaker. So then the question arises, well, might all that we need to account for the thing about practical role, thing about the terms, be the kinds of stuff that everyone will need to do to account for the way in which or the manner of words can be used evaluatively? So that's just kind of first quick consideration. Here's probably a more kind of central and pertinent one. You don't have to take this from me. Some of the people who are kind of developing the kinds of views that I have in my sites here observe these kinds of things themselves. So, here's the observation. Even like paradigmatic thing about the terms like good and ought are often used literally to state about the verdicts in ways that don't commit the speaker to thinking, feeling, or acting in accordance with those verdicts. So, Matthew Chrisman, for example, observes that there are contexts where you could preface somebody's on the face of unadorned use of ought with phrases such as according to the values of capitalism or on a Catholic Christian way of thinking. And Chrisman proposes that such speakers in the relevant kinds of context need not be seen as endorsing a commitment to having such verdicts as that one ought to prioritize profit over fairness in the case of the capitalist thing, or that one ought to abstain from extramarital sex in the case of the Christian thing, influence her reasoning about what to do, think, or feel. Rather, what one might be literally using ought in this kind of context just to state verdicts about what follows from some contextually assumed body of values or norms need not play a practical role for the speaker. Okay, so here's then kind of the caveats that I was gesturing at earlier when I gave the first pass statements of the different kinds of semantic views. It looks like we need to distinguish two different ways in which thing about the terms can be used. Call one of them non-committal. So from now on, for the interest of my time, I'll be just focusing on ought. Pretty much everything that I say should apply also to good with appropriate modifications, so I'll just talk about ought. So we need to distinguish non-committal uses of ought. So these would be uses that merely describe the verdicts of some assumed system of norms or values. And we can contrast those with committal uses of ought, which also, in addition to stating verdicts of some body of norms, also somehow convey practical commitments to acting, thinking, or feeling in certain kinds of ways. And it seems to me that neither of those semantic views, the meta-semantic view or the assertability semantic view, is plausibly understood as a general account of the meanings of the thinking about the terms. And I'm not here holding their proponents to such an ambition. It seems, given the kinds of observations that, for example, I reported Chrisman offering us, it seems more plausible to interpret those views as offering an account of what finivalti terms mean in their committal uses. Okay, if that's so, then that means that their use to affirm practical commitments wouldn't be a conventional regularity that shows up in all normal contexts of literal use. It would be a feature only of certain kinds of literal uses in normal contexts, the committal ones. At this point, there's a question of how the kind of summative view is drawn to a kind of semantic account of the relation between practical role of thinivalti terms and their practical role should go. You might think, okay, well, let's posit an ambiguity or polysemy of certain sort. But, you know, linguists would tell us that that's often kind of a costly move. You would need really good evidence for that. Maybe not something that you should rush headlong into. So what might you do instead? Well, earlier I observed very quickly that terms like good and ought seem to be semantically undetermined. Depending on context, terms like ought can be used to express what ought to happen or what you ought to do by the standards of 1918 Boy Scouts handbook, or what we ought to do by the standards of, you know, what my cat wants, or what we ought to do by standards of like maximizing consumption of good beer, or what we might do morally speaking, or whatever is expressed by statements like, well, I know I morally ought to fight, but do I? Is it really the case that I ought to fight? So there's lots of contextual variations. So then we might think, well, perhaps instead, a semantic view restricted to accounting for what thinivalti terms mean in their committal uses ought to focus on accounting for behavior of, the meaning of thinivalti terms in context. And that might give semantic view resources for dealing with this complication that it seems like thinivalti terms can be used literally normal context in non-committal and committal ways. Okay, so what I'm going to do next then is to use kind of standard sort of semantic treatment, not uncontroversial, but standard sort of semantic treatment of deontic modals like ought in first order compositional semantics, and then argue that in the context of that kind of semantics, we don't have reason to think of the practical role of thinivalti terms in their committal uses placed in the robust theoretical explanatory role in our semantics. So that would be against the semantic view, and then I'll try to briefly flag how things might go for the assertability, what kinds of problems the arguments I'll give might raise from that. Okay, so we are now moving on to section 4 of the handout. So what I'm going to argue is that even the standard semantics of all the non-linguists have all sorts of language, there's no compelling reason to build the difference between committal and non-committal uses of ought into our overall semantic theory in the way that the meta-semantic view or the assertability view claims. Okay, so the standard semantics here is the kind of thing that was has been most prominently developed by Kratzer, and then of course there's all kinds of tweaks in contemporary and more recent work. But for my purpose, I can stay at the kind of like with a fairly simple, simplified presentation of the kind of theory that that I'm going to be using here as the context. So this view ought is a context-sensitive modal operator. If you want to know how things might go for good, you might think of semantics of good that treats as a gradual adjective. Lots of parallel points will go through there. Okay, so on this semantics of ought, expression of the form ought p, where p is a proposition for example, some states of affairs. So that modal is a linguistic device for shifting the circumstances relative to which that embedded content p needs to be semantically evaluated at some world of evaluation w. So I'm just going to give you like the simple technical gloss and then give some examples that hopefully will help to kind of understand how this is supposed to work. So what ought then does, when it's used in some context, is to determine some set of worlds that are relevant to modeling those circumstances that, you know, we are shifting along two contextual parameters. You might think of one as which worlds matter in the relevant context. In the technical jargon, that's called the modal base. It's a function from the world of evaluation to set of worlds that are compatible with it. And then the second parameter is, given some set of rules that matter, how we rank them. Technical term for that, ordering source, that's a function from W, the set of best worlds in the model base, depending a little bit on what exactly you think the normative force of what is. So I'm assuming there is some presumably fairly small set at the top of the rank. Maybe it's a unique best. That's typically called to be for must rather than ought. Again, that shouldn't matter for my purposes. And how are these? How do these ordering? It's an ordering that we get from a ranking that's produced by whichever body of norms or values or from sticky standards is selected in the relevant context. Okay, so call that first function f, the second function g. So then we can just point an expression fg compatible worlds. That's going to be the set of best worlds that are determined by the context of the utterance and the world of evaluation. Okay, so that's kind of the technical building blocks. So now we can just like give a simple moral rule for the truth conditions of expressions of the form called p relative to a context world pair. So that's the thing at the bottom of the page 2 on the right column handout. So that says, so the double bracket there is just the kind of notation that takes us from linguistic expression to its semantic value. So linguistic expression of the form of P, when the contextual parameters f and g are kind of fixed for context, that's going to be true just in case all of the fg compatible worlds are worlds where the embedded content p is true. So for example, now we get to find an example. So for example, if we have a sentence like you ought to abstain from premarital sex, that seems like it's plausibly true when used to make a claim about living a Catholic life. The idea would be that if the relevant ordering source in the context is something about standards of living a Christian Catholic life, and the set of worlds that matter for ought is something like set of worlds that are compatible with your practical situation, so let me secure something like ought implies can, then this statement is also going to be true, because it's also going to be true that in all the best worlds, by that ranking of worlds that are compatible with your practical situation, you indeed do abstain from premarital sex. But again, equally plausibly, that claim you ought to abstain from premarital sex is going to be false if it's used to make a claim about achieving the best hedonic quality of life. Because one, it seems arguable that when you take the world, set of worlds that's compatible with your practical situation, and we rank them in terms of achieving the best hedonic quality of life, it will not be the case that of all the best worlds are ones where you're abstaining from premarital sex, at least given plausible assumptions about hedonic quality of premarital sex. I'm not going to get into that empirical dispute here, so just, you know, we can change the example if you have different empirical views there. Okay, so in general, and here's kind of something that matters for my purposes, the content of the contextually fixed ranking of worlds is semantically unspecified. It just doesn't show up anywhere in the kind of the basic rule for assigning truth conditions to sentences Okay, so now, question for the meta-semantic view. What kind of meta-semantic work do the practical commitments that term ought may be used to affirm, explaining what ought statements mean, what they do, and here, like, in the context of committal views? That's kind of the game. Well, so we've already seen, it doesn't seem possible that a practical role is going to explain any context invariant aspects of the meaning of ought. Directly, the content of an ought sentence is determined simply by the ranking of the worlds plus the set of worlds that matter, the model base, that's all in the context, irrespective of why or how that ranking or that set of worlds is selected. Nothing requires the ranking to be such that the speaker is committed to acting or reacting in accordance with its verdicts. And that's kind of already what we saw when we observed that these terms can be used in non-committal ways. But perhaps, kind of carrying through the thought that I introduced a few minutes ago, perhaps the practical role could be used to determine what thought means in context. Certainly, the standard semantics that I very briefly fleshed out allows that at least some contexts, perhaps even many contexts, may permit only rankings that are compatible with certain practical commitments. So then the speaker's practical commitments can be one factor that helps to make certain ranking the relevant one in a particular context. So I think we should accept that the practical role of ought can play what I'll call an indirect metasemantic role, helping to select a certain ranking of words as that which is fed into the moral rule for ought to produce its truth conditions, at least in context of committal use. Okay, so I'm granting that. So you might think then, okay, well, so we have practical role of ought of being allowed to play a certain kind of metasemantic role in certain kinds of contexts of use of ought. Okay, so doesn't that sound like a great prospect for this metasemantic view? So what I'll now suggest is that, well, it's not because what I've just granted, the kind of indirect metasemantic role that practical role theological terms can play among maybe other factors is going to be too weak to give any to plausibly kind of make a robust showing in our explanation of what theological terms mean even in context. Okay. Well, let me first kind of give something to my opponent why this might seem like a promising prospect. So one thing you might know, well, if we've got like n possible worlds in the contextually selected modal base, there's going to be n factorial ways of ordering those worlds. So lots of ways of ordering those worlds. But equally clearly, it seems like not just any ranking will do. So for example, you ought to study, but it's better for you to party than to study in some incoherent if the world ordering is the same. So you ought to study can be used to assert that you will study in all the maximally bad worlds. But without some clues as to which of these rankings the audience, with that still remaining in the game, the audience should use in interpreting an utterance, it's hard to see how we should normally manage to focus on a unique ranking of worlds in the way that we seem to do in ordinary relative discourse. We typically don't have too much difficulty zeroing on how our interlocutors are ranking. So, then you might think, well, appeal to the speaker's practical commitments might help us explain how we normally manage to select unique ranking in context. That's something that we could look for as a clue in picking on a particular one from multiplicity of options that might otherwise seem to be on the table. And what I'm going to suggest is that this reasoning doesn't support the metasemantic view as a robust explanatory hypothesis about the semantic component of all. So first, kind of three minor points that cumulatively I think have some weight, and then a more systematic one. So here's the first minor point. If some factor F, speaker's practical commitments, there are others, we'll get to that shortly, plays only an indirect role in fixing that some sentence S means P in context C, the semantic content of that sentence in that context won't entail information to the effect that that factor F holds. So it's not going to pass that kind of test for giving a piece of information as semantics. It won't give us a kind of a grip on kind of a consistency and contradiction judgments of the sort that I use our evidence as evidence in semantic theorizing. Secondly, communication won't always require all convinced conversational participants to select a unique ranking of worlds. A set of rankings that overlap at the top end will typically suffice. So we might not need to put too much weight on the question of, well, how do we manage to settle on a unique ranking of worlds? It's not often quite that demanding in so far as communication goes. Finally, helping select an evaluative system doesn't require much uniformity in practical commitments. So that kind of thing might be secured already if some speakers are committed to certain desires or plans, others to certain effective states or modes of reasoning, etc., etc. Once we know only just one or other of those sorts of things on the speaker, we can use that as a clue to figuring out how they are meaning to use or. So in that event, we would only secure the practical role of ought as just kind of round back category, which would be kind of very heterogeneous and therefore not likely to play a robust explanatory role. Okay, so those are just like a bit of loosening. So here's a more systematic. In addition to the practical role of thinking about the terms, myriad other contextual factors can also help select the ranking of the world in context, whether that context is one of committal use or non-committal use. So here are some examples: mutual beliefs and presuppositions, social influences, the structure of the discourse so far, and there's more. At least so far as we can suss out from the current state of the art on the meta-semantics of context-sensitive terms. Heavily underdeveloped area of linguistic philosophy of language, but there's kind of more work. People are starting finally to kind of be able to move a little bit beyond the nuances and things like that into more complex kind of expressions. But here we are talking about the things that are quite more complex than simple demonstrative things like that. But it seems like these are the kinds of factors that can also play a role in helping select ranking of worlds in context. But not only might these be among other factors that can do that, there's also no reason why such other factors wouldn't sometimes override the speaker's commitments in selecting a ranking. So for example, discourse structure and shared presuppositions might be liable to override the practical commitments of a student body that cares primarily about partying or is indifferent to academic success in determining what ought means in a context where instructors and students are discussing and revising for exams. So that's kind of like the type of example that indicates that there's no reason why these kind of other practices might sometimes override speakers' practical commitments. So you might very well get a student to agree that they ought to do such and such in terms of like studying, even if their real practical commitments are kind of disposed towards other kinds of endeavors. Probably doesn't happen in Cambridge as much as Leeds, but it does happen in Leeds, I can tell you. Okay. Now, so turning on to the final page of the handout, so hopefully 5 minutes, I might not get all the way to the end, but I'm within there. So, what this is, these kind of observations are meant to suggest is that if the practical role of thought plays only an indirect meta-semantic role of the kind that I suggested or fleshed out, it won't constrain or explain what thought means in all committal contexts, or play any distinctive role in explaining what thought means. But one might have the impression that somehow the practical role of thinking about the term is supposed to be somehow special and distinctive feature of them. Point would be, so far as the meta-semantic work, that it might be recruited to play. It doesn't look to be so. It's one thing to grab that in committal uses the practical role of thought can play an indirect meta-semantic role. Quite another to say that this gives the practical role of thought a robust explanatory role regarding what thought means in context of committal use. In the longer paper, I explain also how a pragmatic explanation of how the invalidative terms are associated with their practical role can co-opt the kind of weak indirect role that practical role might play in metasemantics. There's also positive reasons to deny the explanatory claim that we've got in the metasemantic view. So here, just to get a little bit of material to work with, I'm just going to put on the table Christman's proposal. So he proposes kind of tentatively a unified meta-semantics of committal and non-committal uses of all. His thought is that the predictions of that moral rule for all that we introduced earlier, that its predictions for the truth conditions, articulate how speakers, his quote, have to think and reason in order to satisfy the implicit conceptual commitments affirmed by using ought to make an assertion in ordinary discursive practice. So what I think is true here is that in affirming only commitments to drawing certain conclusions, speakers who use ought non-committally seem to be in different states of mind from those who use it committally. But the moral rule for ought neither predicts different truth conditions, at least in certain cases of committal and non-committal use of all, nor gives a different explanation of the same truth condition. So here's an example. Consider the following sentence. One ought to use one's turn signal at least 50% more than one's middle finger. So two speakers might both be using the sentence to make a claim about what contemporary driving etiquette requires, but where only one of them also affirms commitments to driving accordingly. If we take that modal rule for ought, it's going to tell us that these utterances will have the same semantic content. The only difference is that committal uses may exploit a further contextual feature in selecting one and the same system of norms. But any other contextual feature that picks up on the same system of norms like shared discourse structure or whatever, would have done just as well. So what that just shows is the context can engage different indirect semantic factors to compute semantic content without any difference in content. And so we don't get, it's hard to say what kind of robust explanatory role the practical role of auth would play there in telling us why, in this kind of context, auth means what it does. Okay, so what about the very briefly then the assertability view? Well, it seems like if the assertability view is to merit the name of being some kind of semantic account, the rule should reflect some kind of linguistic convention that governs only committal uses of auth and not non-committal uses of auth. But why do one exists? To figure out whether the speaker is using auth in a committal way, we need to know various things about the context of utterance and the speaker's state of mind. But it's unclear why such factors would have to grow a linguistic convention in order for speakers to succeed in conveying certain practical commitments by uttering all sentences. So I think we've yet to see evidence why we should think that the difference between committal and non-committal uses of certain evaluative terms is something that is marked by linguistic convention as opposed to various kinds of less committal ways of explaining how certain contexts of utterance differ in the ways that committal and non-committal uses differ. So it's one thing to acknowledge that utterances may differ with respect to whether they can be reasonably interpreted as using auth in a committal way, given some tests for such uses. Why can others say that this matters to what auth means in context? And I'll just iterate to say this, you need not be commitment phobic. You need not say that there can be, you needn't deny that there can be auth concepts that are concepts that are individuated in part by a relation to certain practical commitments. The general thought would be mental and linguistic representation are subject to different constraints. It might not be possible to distinguish uses of auth that express committal auth concepts from uses that express non-committal auth concepts by their semantic or metasemantic features. It might be that we need to mark those distinctions somewhere else in our overall theory of linguistic communication. Okay, so I think I'm out of time. I can say 2 minutes about broader implications, but I'm happy to stop for a discussion. I'll leave that as the chair's call.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.